Are you ready to join me in transforming fear to freedom? That's the objective of the show. Are you ready to explore with me and my guests? Are you ready to get into the deep and play? This is where it's at, and that's what it's all about. No medical advice here. Use discernment and decide for yourself if the information is right for you. All views and opinions expressed on this show belong to the individual and are not necessarily shared with the producer of the show. Want more details? Go to letsgetrealchatwithkatherine.com. Now let's get real and have some fun. Who are we going to explore with today? Come on with me and let's get into the deep.
And we are back once again on Let's Get Real, chatting with Catherine. And today I am super, super delighted to be able to bring you this, one of the speakers from the International Kinesiology Conference 2015 that's being held in Banff, Alberta, Canada, September 23rd to the 27th. Dr. Charles Krebs is my guest today, and I am going to read you some of his bio.
Dr. Charles Krebs began his professional career with a PhD in biology and physiology from Boston University. After teaching marine biology and neuroanatomy for a number of years at St. Mary's College in Maryland, in 1983 he moved to Australia as a marine research scientist at the Marine Sciences Laboratory in Queenscliff, Victoria. Shortly after his move, a near-fatal scuba diving accident left him paralyzed from the waist down and opened the door to a new chapter in his life. Through his knowledge of anatomy and physiology and his ability to move chi with his mind from years of martial arts training, he learned to walk again. Quite a miraculous recovery, which we're going to talk about. He went on to be principal research scientist, head of Water Quality Laboratory, Environmental Protection Authority of Victoria from 1985 to 1988. And during his period of recovery, he sought alternative and complementary therapies to help him walk better, including massage, chiropractic, osteopathy, homeopathy, naturopathy, acupuncture, and even Filipino faith healing. But kinesiology, a form of direct muscle biofeedback, helped him the most. And which is why he is a speaker at the International Kinesiology Conference in Banff, Alberta, Canada, in September 23rd to the 27th. And you can actually hear him speak there, meet him, and he'll have his books available, or his books will be available there as well. So this is going to be quite a fascinating conference, and his talk, I imagine, will be incredible to many people, lay people as well as practitioners. So you can read his full bio at www.lgrcc.com under the tab on the top, Inspiring Guests, and then just look for his name. All of his websites, addresses, and more information is available there, as along with the titles of some of his books, A Revolutionary Way of Thinking, From a Near-Death Fatal Accident to a New Science of Healing. That's one. Energetic Kinesiology is another. And Nutrition for the Brain, Feeding Your Brain for Optimum Performance, is another. As well as he's had several books, I think four books, that are translated into German. So that's also...
So he's a remarkable man with a remarkable story. And we're going to find out, get to know him a little bit better through this chat today. And then, like I say, you can go to the website and get the links to his CV, and also you can go to www.celebrate2015.com, which is the link to how you can sign up, register, even, you know, the public, it's open to the public, which is super cool. And to hear some of these speakers, take some of the workshops, is all very interactive. And if you want to know more specifically about what all is involved with this conference, take a look at the interview I did with Joanne Lee Marichu. She is the chair of the conference, and we covered everything from the food to the location to what to expect from speakers and vendors and what's open and everything. So it's going to be really exciting, and I'm really excited to be able to share this information with you. it wasn't that long ago that the majority of science papers and this kind of wisdom was kind of in a separate domain, not so much the public. And now we're being invited into this. And so I'm taking this invitation and I'm embracing it wholeheartedly. And so enjoy this chat. And like I say, share, subscribe to the YouTube channel and get this information out to the world, because you just don't know who's going to benefit from knowing some of this information. So let's get into this chat today with Dr. Charles Krebs right now on Let's Get Real Chatting with Catherine. All right, so welcome back to Let's Get Real Chatting with Catherine, and we're going to get inspired today. I can just feel it as we talk to Dr. Charles Krebs. Welcome to the show, Dr. Charles Krebs. I'm so excited.
So thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I call myself a leading edge broadcaster because we don't see these kinds of shows on a lot of mainstream media. But people, the masses are looking. They are open. They're open to, you know, what else is possible. I just can feel this shift, and this whole conference is going to be, it's just going to be filled with that kind of energy of new thought. But let's, I encourage people to go to the website lgrcc.com and read your bio and your CV and all what you've been through, because we would take more than an hour just to go through all of that. But let's begin kind of at the beginning. If you can give a little synopsis, because you've had what I would call, what most people would call, a miraculous life.
Yeah, I mean, let's start in the beginning. I grew up on a farm, you know, taking care of horses and cattle and milk cows, and you know, and then I basically lived in the outdoors. I just loved nature. Yeah. And I at 9 years old, I'd take my sleeping bag and say, "Mom, I'm gonna go sleep up in the valley of the pines and just go up and sleep in the woods by myself with bears and stuff." I mean, but my mother let me. That was the thing. One of my friends one time said, "Did your mother let you do that?" And I went, "I never thought about it." Yeah. But she let me do that, you know.
Yeah. So those are the good old days, so to speak.
Oh, yes. But now she'd probably be arrested and I'd be put in foster care or something.
That's right.
But I had this kind of, you know, really lovely upbringing on the farm. And then we moved to a big suburb of a big town called Glens Falls, South Glens Falls. And I did my high school there, which is good because I had a gifted and talented program. And that was much more challenging for me than a regular school.
Right.
And then I went to Boston University and did my undergraduate in pre-med and in physiology and anatomy. And then I decided not to go to med school because when I'd go for the interviews, they would say, you know, well, how much money do you expect to make and these kind of things. I thought, what's that got to do with a doctor? But second of all, the thing that clinched it is I say, as far as I can see, the whole Western medical approach to medicine and healing is a treatment of symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I said, how does treating symptoms cure anything? Unless the symptom and cure are directly related, like gangrene and bacteria, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And that was it. You're off. So I then went to graduate school because I also had applied to a number of graduate schools. And I went to Boston University graduate school and I started in paleontology and evolutionary biology. And then I went from that to population. Then I moved to marine science laboratory. And that laboratory comes from living in Australia for a long time. Laboratory.
Yeah, that's right. Fine. You know, we've got people listening all over the world, so whatever accent fine. You use is fine.
And the marine science, my marine biological lab is one of the best marine labs in the world. I did my PhD there, then on population dynamics and ecology. But in studying, which is interesting, my name Krebs in German means crabs, and I studied crabs. there's an oil spill, and then I got involved in analytical chemistry to solve the problem of what was happening to the crabs, and became an analytical chemist also. And then I went to Maryland, taught for 9 years in anatomy and physiology, and I taught invertebrate zoology, and as well as a lot of other areas. And at the St. Mary's College of Maryland. And then I had a friend from Woods Hole, and she was an analytical chemist and geochemist, and we'd done our research together. And so they'd moved to Australia. And I'd always wanted to go to Australia, right? And so here's a chance. So we wrote four grants, twice we got one out of two, and we weren't picked, right? Because But then it turned out that her husband was a mad sailor, and I've sailed with them a lot in Cape Cod and Atlantic. And so Hidden has built a 45-foot steel catch, and they're going to make the maiden voyage to Tasmania. So how could you turn that down?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
My wife, we happened to have a mini mester like during January. We had like 6 weeks of time. So my wife and I flew down to Australia and we looked at the environs of Melbourne, which in Melbourne itself, and she was at the Marine Science Laboratory in Queenscliff, which is at the mouth of Port Phillip Bay, the bay that's 20 miles by 26 miles that Melbourne sits on top of, right?
Okay.
And so we sailed to Tasmania, which is an amazing place, and the trip was amazing. So and I walked on the beach having a beer, talking to the head of the lab, and I went to basically for a job there. You know, Australia is much more relaxed. You know, they say in Australia, we say here at TGIF, mm-hmm. thank God it's Friday. There they say poets, piss off early, tomorrow's Saturday.
I like it.
A little more relaxed attitude.
Very, yes.
And I'd moved there as to do analytical chemistry to set up a marine pollution monitoring program for the state of Victoria.
Okay.
And after being there 6 months and just loving it, you know, I went on this wonderful scuba, and I'd been diving all over the world, and I went on this wonderful scuba diving expedition by some people, friends of Bob McCarthy's, that owned a dive boat, and they were professional divers. I was a professional diver, and we went down to Wilson's Promontory, which is this incredible granitic peninsula that sticks out into the Bass Strait. Just spectacular, you know.
Yeah.
It's an Aboriginal power spot, and you can feel that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge national park. And so we were diving, and we've been diving progressively deeper every day because they thought they'd seen an old wreck from the 1800s at about 200 feet, and that's called the limits of air diving.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but you're below that, you have to use mixed gases like helium, oxygen. And so, and when you dive deeper and deeper every day, you release cavitation points, so you're less and less likely to get bent on a deep dive, right? And so we've been doing everything right. Did a perfect dive. It was just miraculous. I mean, oh, unbelievably beautiful. But we went through a thermocline about two different temperature layers of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so sharp. My hand was at 5 degrees centigrade. My shoulders at 15 degrees centigrade.
Wow.
So the water was below was very cold, but very clear. I mean, it's spectacular. And these huge boulders, like 90 feet high boulders, and it was just an amazing thing. And at one point, I was looking between these boulders into a cave, and I had my arm like this. Next thing I have a seal's head under my arm looking in there to see what I'm looking at.
What an amazing experience.
Oh.
Truly.
It was a spectacular dive. We came up, and then I had what is called a type 2 cerebral spinal bend. So bends are when as you go deeper and deeper, there's 78% nitrogen in the atmosphere. More and more of that gas gets pushed into your bloodstream. And at a certain level, it starts to affect your thinking.
Yeah.
So normally they call it drunkenness of the deep. You know, you start making not good decisions. I'd been there diving in Eniwetok in the Marshall Islands, at about 190 feet, you know, I was trying to put this coral in a plastic bag, and I'd open the bag up, and I'd pick the coral up, and of course the bag would have collapsed. I put the coral down, I opened it. After about the third time, when I saw the shark swim by, I went, I want to pet the shark. I said, it's time to go up. This is when you need to go up. This is, you're not thinking too clearly anymore.
Yeah.
Right? So I'd known that, but I'd never known the other side of it, which is what happened to me in this dive. So at the bottom, at the deepest point, I had been, you know, I had my big blood vessels, like, you know, opened up because we were warm going down. And we went through the thermocline at some point to hold core temperature. The body subconsciously, you know, reduces the size of the vessels into the arms and legs because they don't need a lot of heat. The body does.
Right.
So as long as your core doesn't get cold, you don't ever think you're consciously cold.
Right.
But of course, that meant that I loaded nitrogen at depth with bigger pipes, and then when we did the decompression stops, I had smaller pipes. And so it was asymmetric. I couldn't get enough out, even though we did technically the right amount. In fact, we even did more extensive. And on the bottom, I got narked in a way I'd never been narked before. And the other side of it is hyper-anxiety.
Yeah,
right?
No so kidding.
Suddenly, I got hyper-anxious on the bottom. But my conscious brain's going, there's nothing to be anxious about. What are you anxious about? So it had nothing to do with each other. I swam over my dive partner. I touched her shoulder, and like that, nothing was gone. She said, what? I said, time check. I didn't know what to say. What was I over there for? you know, but that meant I breathed more rapidly and deeper because of the hyper anxiety at that depth, and I just overloaded my system with nitrogen.
Oh boy.
And so bends can take the form of when you try to straighten your arm, it hurts. And the reason they call it the bends is when you, you know, bend your arms, you basically reduce the pressure in the joint, and the bubbles pop up. Now there's no pressure outside, the bubbles pop out as bubbles in the joint, in the synovial fluid. So then when you go to extend your arms, you're now crushing these bubbles, which make it hurt.
Yes.
So you tend to bend yourself up as a means of reducing the pain.
Right, right.
That's how the name bends came along.
Yeah.
So that's called a type 1 bend. That's the most common bend in the joints.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
But I had what's called a type 2 bend. So the bubbles formed inside my brain and inside my spinal cord. And the problem there is there's no, you know, your skin can expand. You're in a box. So as the bubbles get bigger, they just crush the neural tissue around them. But worse than that, they block the blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I had a lot of hypoxic damage to my central nervous system, my spinal cord, and my brain.
Right.
So we came up and it looked like it was a perfect dive. I knew I had a little joint bend. We put another tank on, went down to 35 feet, did 45 feet of what's called wet recompression. Should have breathed out all the nitrogen, came back to the surface, feeling pretty good. Went in, grabbed a cup of tea, went and sat down, and it was a dive boat. They had a medical dive book, so I just popped it out and was reading about it. And it said, oh, type 2 bends, you know, these are when the cerebral spinal bends, and when they're 95% fatal. You know,
yeah.
So,
yeah, that's what I was going to say. In theory, wouldn't most people die right at that point?
Yep. And the other ones are joint bends and they're trivial. And so da 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 da. And it said the key features that let you know it's a cerebrospinal bend is that you have locomotor incoordination called the staggers, and you cannot void urine. Right.
Yeah.
And of course, I've been drinking tea and just came up and diving. I had to go to the head. So all of a sudden, I'm getting up and my arms are shaking and my legs are, what the? I get to the head and I can't pee. So then I knew I had a type 2 cerebrospinal bend. And, you know, and the whole story is in the chapter and the thing.
And people can get the book and
read
the whole thing. The links are on the website.
Yeah. So I ended up, you know, with a type 2 cerebrospinal bend, and I was paralyzed and neck down from C5. I mean, it was just a whole series of weird synchronicities in so many different ways, which is described. But it left me a C5 quadriplegic. But I was in it, but the site, and I was being supposed to be flown out this platform, an ESSEL platform off the shore. But the helicopters got all mixed up because of this, there was a crew change day and they're all going out there. And the other helicopter from Melbourne flew down, but it didn't have pontoons, so it couldn't fly me across the water. So I had to wait for 5.5 hours of the helicopter. And by then, I was a C5 quadriplegic, you know. And I then had a treatment.
How many years ago was that?
1981, January 1982.
Okay.
And so the doctor, who was a very, this is bizarre, Outback Australia, there are two GPs who are experts in decompression sickness. Why? Because the Bass Strait oil field is right off Barnsdale where they live, and they've been treating these guys for 20 years, right? And so this guy, and I owe my life to two very weird things. The first one is the Jones Act of 1955 in the U.S. Congress. And the second is the Crane Operators Union of Australia. Now, how the hell can those two come together to save your life, right? Well, it turns out the Jones Act says that if you are an American company operating in a foreign land and a U.S. citizen is in difficulty, you're obligated to do everything you can to help them. I'm American. ESSEL rig. Here we go. The ESSEL lawyers freaked out that if they couldn't show they did everything to save me, my parents would sue them, this being the land of the Sioux, right?
Yeah.
And so, and the second part was the Crane Operators Union. Well, normally that crew that went out should be in that chamber at 240 feet of pressure. You can't knock on the door and walk in. But because the two Australian Crane Operators Union were having a demarcation dispute over who's going to lift these pipes, nobody was in the chamber. They're out chipping paint waiting for the strike to be over. So the chamber was empty. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been available.
That's amazing. Talk about synchronicities, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's synchronicity. And,
yeah.
and synchronicity three, Jeff McFarland, the doctor is in there with me, had been at a conference on decompression sickness in Cambridge, England, 3 weeks before my accident, talking to the world's expert in decompression sickness, Philip James, about a case like mine, what would you do? right? And so they had this whole discussion over a beer, over a pint in a pub in England, right? Mm-hmm. And so he called Philip James up, and he said, look, he said, I did an experiment on a pig, and the pig lived. I think it's his only chance. So, I mean, so then we did this thing. It had never been tried before in the world, and it was very successful because I came out of the decompression chamber, not a C5 quad, but a T9 paraplegic in a wheelchair, right? And so, you know, so that was this incredible synchronicities. And then through a whole process, because I'd been a martial artist and a fairly high-level martial artist, and I have a very strong will, and I have a photographic 3D photographic memory. I know the whole nervous system. I can just visualize it in my head. And so I would just send chi down specific nerve pathways to specific muscles and reactivate them until I could walk again. I mean, it's not something that's very reproducible, you know.
But you didn't receive any significant brain damage from the well, it was just...
You know, I had a lot of spinal damage from the inferior olive of my lower brainstem to C5. There's massive, you know, what they call astrocytic scars in my spinal cord, which means a lot of loss, a lot of neurons. And so technically, it looked like I should never walk again, right? And also, I'd had patchy frontal lobe damage. And so that gives you what's called frontal lobe syndrome. So, you know, I couldn't organize my thinking. So after I got out of the hospital, in 9.5 months, I walked again using canes and using not walking well. But I wanted to, you know, walk better. And so I said, look, the doctor thought I was going to die for sure. I mean, he had no chance of me surviving.
Yeah.
In fact, he had to have, since of the quadriplegic, he had to have another diver volunteer to go in the chamber with him because he couldn't handle me by himself, right? And the guy said, wait a second, I'll run down and get my toothbrush. And he said, don't bother, you're not going to need it. He's not going to last that long. So I know he didn't have any hope I was going to make it at the time. But he was
I mean, he must have had a degree of hope, but he didn't have a degree of that it could be, you know, because he wouldn't have endeavored to do it.
And then I think, but once we got in there, then he tried all these different things, and that was wonderful. So I then said, look, I want to walk better than I walk. They did. They kept me alive. I got myself walking. I want to walk better. I'll try alternative things. I know nothing about them. I'm an analytical chemist, a little woo-woo, but I've done a lot of, you know, I had some fairly interesting psycho-emotional experiences. You know, 1969, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So I'd had some experiences with altered states of consciousness, you might say. And I'd also had done meditation, so I had a sense of, you know, how the mind and body can interact. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'll try them. I'll give them a chance. You know, if they say 3 months, 6 months, I'll do it for that long. If I don't see any change... It's not that they're not good. It's not what I need. I'll try something else.
That's a really big key right there, how everything is going to be different for each person.
Yeah, and you can't, and then we don't really know what the underlying issue was, so, you know, you didn't know what was really going to work.
Yes.
But I then tried kinesiology and acupressure, and in an hour and a half, my whole neurology was reorganized. You know, I went in there with a cane, arched my hips and dragging my feet, and I dragged them so bad I wore steel plates off my shoes once a month. I walked out holding my cane in a much more normal gait.
Wow.
I had a limp, but, you know, and that was 2.5 years after my accident. Now, according to neurophysiology, that is impossible, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, since it happened, it's not impossible. So what that means for a real scientist is your model is incorrect, that or your model is incomplete.
Yeah.
And what they didn't know about is qi and the fact that qi can affect physiology.
Yeah.
That's not part of Western model of thinking or of medicine, right? Mm-hmm. But that's what reactivated the neurons, was me moving qi with my mind, mm-hmm. right? And so then I began to be fascinated. How did this happen? But at that point, then I went back to work as a chief analytical chemist and head of the water quality lab for the state of Victoria in Australia. And so I was 60 hours a week being head of the lab and doing analytical chemistry. And the other 20, 30 hours a week, I was now learning kinesiology and then practicing kinesiology and seeing changes that were impossible according to my knowledge of, you know, anatomy and physiology. And then that's what got me on the track of, and at a certain point, after 2.5 years of doing this two-time thing, I said, I'm going to do, you know, I mean, there's a book in the 1970s by Carlos Castaneda called Don Juan, The Teachings of a Yaqui Indian, you know, and he was a shaman, you know.
Yeah.
And so Don Juan one time asked me, he said, Carlos Castaneda asked Don Juan, he said, what's the difference between a normal person and a warrior? And Don Juan's answer was simple. He said, the warrior always walks the path with heart, that which fulfills his heart. And for me, research science had always been my path with heart. From the time I was a child, I was doing experiments, right? And now, really, healing was my path with heart. So I just resigned my job and went over to the United States and learned applied physiology with my mentor, Richard Ott, and then continued to develop that. And I developed a whole program for learning problems using acupressure to resynchronize brain function because I understood the whole neurology. Mm-hmm. I just had to work out how to access that. And Richard and I worked out a whole system for that. And so that's what I've been doing since then, is just improving this program and taking it to greater depth.
Yeah, and applying it to different different areas that are, you know, people's learning and with children and so forth. I understand you're doing, are you teaching and facilitating these movements, or are you like the hands-on guy?
Yeah, no, I'm the hands-on guy. I've worked with tens of thousands of clients myself. Mm-hmm. But I also taught all around the world as teachers in 5 countries and taught, you know, thousands of practitioners in the last 30 years. You know,
and that's LEAP, is it called?
Yeah, yes. Learning Enhancement Acupressure Program.
Right. And that is being taught around the world now too for people too.
Yep.
So not to jump ahead on your story, but I'm just curious about what kinds of things does kinesiology, the understanding, this understanding that crosses bridges, where do we apply this? What other things? Not everybody's going to be a deep sea diver or have that kind of a problem, but there's other areas.
In fact, what's happened is over the years, because I have this extensive knowledge of neurology, I've applied it to skeletal muscular problems, to hormonal problems, to allergies and all kinds of, the types of problems, as well as learning and as well as all kinds of psycho-emotional problems, because they all interface at this basic level. And that basic level is one where you have the neuronal system and its synchronization. It can be modulated and affected and integrated by movement of qi. And we can do that with the law of 5 elements in Chinese acupuncture, by using chakra corrections, even light, lasers, this in a variety of ways that you can make a correction that changes in the synchrony and timing of the signals.
Yeah.
That changes the function.
Yeah. And it's not like with you, it was I had to do it yourself because nobody really knew how. You had to move this. But now people are actually helping, especially in the Western world. I know in China and so forth, they've been using acupuncture and acupressure for years. One of my guests on my show, Mike Lang, he is taught by his mother, who is a Mongolian acupressure, and he uses seeds on the ears and does fascinating work. And that's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
But for Western medicine and they seem to be blending now. People are more open. More Western doctors are starting to say, I'm sick and tired of just patching people up. I want to bring them to actual wellness. So do you see that happening more and more?
My talk at the conference is about what I call a new paradigm in medicine. Mm-hmm. It's informational medicine. So if you reduce medicine to its most simple, or healing to its most simple form, is information. Mm-hmm. The body always heals itself, but why doesn't it in certain cases? The information it needs to heal got blocked.
Right.
Now, in the Chinese system, they see that it's blocked qi flow, and the yoga system is blocked pranic flow, and other systems, there's all kinds of different models.
Yes.
But the information is not getting to the being that then, when it has that information, heals like that.
Yeah.
Right? And so what is it? It's frequency. Right, so I would say all you need is love. I said all you need is frequency, but like love, it needs to be coherent. Mm-hmm. So if the frequencies are coherent and the right frequencies for the imbalance, it'll heal instantly, mm-hmm. or very close to instantly.
And there is some work being done on that frequency. The 528 hertz or something, saying that using that frequency actual whatever it is, changing the frequency that we're actually used to listening to and using that higher frequency, which is the frequency of love, how that actually can help with healing. Do you do any work with that sound?
I use tuning forks. I use crystals and color. I use lasers. I use hands-on things. I use a thing called a mega wand, which is basically crystals and scalar frequencies in a device that you just hold against the point. You know, I use some basic psycho-emotional, more like kind of Reiki, but it's a different type. But it's just a pure energy healing, because it depends on what that body needs at that moment. One of the things that kinesiology provides, I did this work out a way to access, is there stress here in this part of the brain?
Yeah.
What kind of stress? But how do I know that? Because I have a biofeedback tool that interfaces at the level of the subconscious. Mm-hmm. So most people think they run their muscles. Mm-hmm. That's not how it is. You run the muscles based on a whole platform of subconscious function. Mm-hmm. If all that platform is in place and working fine, then the muscles do what you tell them.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's imbalances within that subconscious function, they don't do what you tell them, right? And so we have a biofeedback tool that we call a muscle biofeedback tool that we call kinesiology. And so this is just putting the arm in a position, you can or be different, or limb in a different position, and asking people to equal your pressure as you apply pressure. Now there's a whole complex mechanism. In my book, Energetic Kinesiology, explains the whole neurology of how it works. Right? It's just straight out of Gray's Anatomy and Guyton's Textbook of Medical Physiology. Nothing mystical here. It's just neurophysiology, not generally understood by most doctors.
And that, can the layperson understand it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that book will be a little more challenging because it has a lot of neurology. But I think that my great gift is I can take complex ideas and express them in analogies that most people understand. So take this one. With the subconscious, you have two sets of pathways that go down the spine from the brain. One is called cortical spinal, and that's your consciousness telling your arm, lift up, hold, right? Then you have what are called extrapyramidal tracts that go down that are subconscious, and they come from the brainstem out of your consciousness. And they go to the proprioceptors that control muscle function and muscle tone, right? And so that determines whether the muscle can lock because they set what's called the load reflex.
Right.
So if I say hold there and then I start to push, the arm goes down a little and then it turns this loop on that's basically like a dimmer switch, right? So if the dimmer switch is all the way up, you can hold. If I turn the dimmer, so the light's a 100-watt light bulb. If I turn the dimmer switch down, it's a 40-watt. It's not a 40-watt light bulb. It's got 40 watts of power.
Mm.
So if I turn the dimmer switch down in those tracks, it just lowers the tone, and then you can't make a load reflex.
Right.
The muscle gives, right? And so, and if you're the consciousness, you can turn the light switch on, but you can't control the dimmer switch. So if you, it doesn't, if it's not, you know, so people say, you're pushing harder. Because I'm pushing really hard on the light switch, but guess what? Nothing's happening. The light switch is already on.
Yeah.
Somebody turned down the dimmer switch.
Right,
and
right.
That's from some other part of your nervous system, and often psycho-emotional parts of your nervous system. So that's why if someone's angry, they're like this. Their body gets big and tense. And if they're sad, they collapse. Well, the muscles are stronger or weaker. Why? Not you have no conscious control of that.
Yeah.
That's why you can tell when people are angry, even when they're trying to deny, I'm not angry. You can't lie, because I can see in your face and your whole stance that your everybody muscle in your fiber and your fiber in your body is tight, you know?
Yes.
And if you're sad, I'm feeling really well. And I look at, no, that's not how you feel, you know? So with these observations we've made for years, have kind of always been denied in science as having any kind of value, you know, or in medicine. It's all, you know, it's all psycho-emotional, it's all in your head. Well, if it's in your head, it's in your body too?
Yeah, that's the key right there, is to understand that and to make that connection. And what you're talking about using, you know, the way you're using the different instruments and so forth, I mean, people have been doing healing work, hands-on and stuff like that for eons, but they didn't get the science. And it's like, science didn't want to go there, didn't want to look at it, so therefore it was woo-woo. And yet, you know, science to me has always been confusing, because people say, well, if the science doesn't prove it, it's not so. And I'm like, isn't science
No.
That's not
true.
No, I know.
And all, so if I'd like sometimes when I'm working with a kid with learning problems, right? And I've had like many doctors bring their teenage, you know, son to me because he has a learning problem.
Yes.
So I'm standing, his arm is going up and down, and his father's kind of cross-armed and looking at me with this kind of look on his face, like, what the, huh? And so I usually just put it in their face. I'd say, sir, I said, you seem to be dubious, skeptical. Well, you know, it looks very strange. I said, what do you know about the chakra nadi system and the rules and principles by which it works? Well, nothing. What do you know about the acupuncture meridian system and rules and principles by which it works? Well, nothing. So therefore, your skepticism is based in ignorance, not knowledge.
Yeah.
Then they realize it's true. So just because they don't know it doesn't make it not true. It just means you're ignorant.
Yeah.
Right? And if you can see outcome, that's what science says is true. Science is about observation. It's anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that as if it's a bad word. No, anecdote means observation.
Yeah.
So you make observations, you make a model. Then you test your model by making more observations and see if that indeed does explain the outcome. Like in my case, you're not supposed to get better. And after 6.5 months or so, you can never get any real significant recovery from a hypoxic injury. 2.5 years later, a whole reorganization of my nervous system. Well, that just invalidates that model because even if it's one, but there's millions of people this has happened to, told you'll never walk again, they do walk again.
Yeah.
Well, oh, it's an exception. Oh, it's a miracle. No, science doesn't allow miracles. There has to be a model. And so part of that is just not understanding that.
Yeah. And the other part of it is that's interesting about that is for many, many years, I mean, we understand a little more now, but for many years, people took their children to the doctor and they poked them and they did things and they didn't understand it. But for some reason, they at the same time, they had that trust in the doctor, not in the process. They didn't understand the process.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's very interesting. What
we're really, and there's a man named Rupert Sheldrake. And Rupert Sheldrake was at Cambridge University. He's a tenured professor. He wrote a book called about the presence of the past. And in this book, he proposes that there are morphogenic fields.
Mm-hmm.
And morphogenic fields are fields created by thought.
Yes.
And that information can be transferred even at a distance, right? And so once you have a new thought, it begins to create a morphogenic field. And at first, only a few people have it, so the field isn't very strong.
Right.
But it explains why you see something that happens again and again and again in science, and that is two people develop a really complex theory or system independently at the same time. Isaac Newton and Wilhelm von Leibniz, they both discovered calculus in the same year at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, what's the problem? Calculus is not a simple system. And then Wallace and Darwin both discovered, you know, evolution, right? I mean, there's hundreds of examples of this in science.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like once you get enough thought and it begins to cohere and have a coherent resonance, other minds can tune into that field.
Yeah.
And then it makes it easier and easier to have that same idea. And so what I think we're seeing right now is a paradigm shift in medicine, and that's going from biochemical, you know, physiological, only physical, to frequency. And you just look everywhere you can see on the internet, people are developing frequency techniques to heal.
Yeah.
And they're being very successful.
And this is really good news for all people who have, I mean, I would think most doctors got into medicine to heal, to help to create a better, you know, better life for their patients and so forth. And to me, this is where we're starting to come to a point of accepting and wanting and demanding that our doctors be more educated and more open to. And yes, yeah. Exactly. Well, you don't find today people go to the doctor, they already kind of have an idea about their body. They're not going and submitting their body as a science project. They're actually saying, you know, I feel like this is going on and that's going on. So they're more informed. And then we need Western and Eastern medicine to sort of blend, right?
Yeah.
And
I think that's because really, when it comes to, like, I cut my fingers off, right? When I cut the two halves of my little finger and ring finger and actually my middle finger, but it's all grafted and was put back together, and also my index finger, or the power saw when I was 13, 12 and a half, 13. Now, that's where you want to go to Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take me to an acupuncturist.
No.
He's not going to put my fingers back on.
No,
they had to. These were so badly damaged they couldn't, put them on. But they did reconstruct the other two fingers, and they've given me a relatively normal grip for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you want to go, yeah. Right?
No, there's there's a place for everything, but it feels like
medicine, right? Acute medicine, Western medicine is hard to beat.
Yes.
But when it comes to chronic medicine, it's been taken over by the drug companies for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they want you to treat symptoms. Because you treat a symptom, they never go away. Yes. If you, they don't want to cure something.
Yes.
If you cure it, it's gone. Yes. Then you can't sell another pill.
Yes.
If you treat the symptom, the headache doesn't hurt now, but it will tomorrow, and another pill, and then hurt it, and another hurt now. No, that, so you that that's what we've got stuck in, is it's been controlled by Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Pharma's in it for a profit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And they want to maximize profit. So they have suppressed many good alternative techniques because they didn't want those techniques to compete with their drugs because they're going to lose money. Not that people would be better.
And I've often wondered about that. Like, why would we want to have a society that's just, you know, sort of unsick or just barely hanging on, barely. I mean, what would be a global mindset that would want a whole mass of people just to be the walking dead as opposed to, and it's so weird.
It's money.
It's
about money.
Yeah.
So, it is. I mean, we have some of the sickest generation, but they live longer. But this is also a lie. People have to understand this nonsense. Oh, they live so much longer today. That's a statistical artifact. Because in 1840, if you lived to be, if you were healthy at 40, you had every bit as much chance of being 85 then as you do today.
Mm.
The difference is many people died at childbirth, and the other ones lived to 80. Well, add them up, 40. People lived to 40. No, not most people lived to 40.
No.
The other people lived a really long time, and other people died younger.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's not the same. This is an artifact, that nonsense. We are living longer in a technical sense, you know, but the thing is, in 1840, if you lived to be 85, you were well, 2 weeks dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you live to 60, and from 60 to 85, you're in various degrees of disability, filled full of medicines.
Yeah.
Now, which one is better? I mean, I don't want all these children dying at birth and in the first few years.
No.
So indeed, having the medicine to treat these, and also like myself, I might not have survived because I lose too much blood.
Yeah.
Right. So and being able to fix acute systems and things like take out cancer and make corrections in the body when it gets injured, this is all where it's really powerful. But the system is taken over. And kind of pushed everything that isn't in that medical biopharma model out and restricted it and suppressed it so that they can maximize profit.
Yeah.
But it's happening anyway.
Yeah.
In spite of that.
And people are starting to decide that they want to live longer, but they want to thrive. They want to be in their 80s and still dancing and climbing mountains and whatever they, and having their brain function and not just filling up nursing homes. I mean, it is a desire within us. And I think a lot of us know it's possible. And that's why I think this conference is going to be vibrating like crazy with all this kind of energy and thought. Plus it's in the mountains, which is high energy to start with. And so it's going to be like, I said, it's the only place that could hold that kind of energy because it's just going to be so much brilliant thought. What, you have the books available. That's one part of it. But do you have seminars and things going on as well? I wanted to just, or ways that people can work with you?
Yeah, I'm doing a series of trainings now. For the last year or so, I've been working with a researcher at Harvard and things. So I haven't had a lot of time to go training.
Right.
But now I'm starting another series of LEAP and starting in November in Salt Lake. I do trainings, and I have trainers, that train the whole system in Australia, in Germany, in Austria, some people in England, Netherlands and Spain. So there's and the U.S. is only beginning to develop because it's been a very antagonistic place to try to do alternative medicine,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't have the support system. So like in Australia in 1995, I started the world's first energetic kinesiology college that was government accredited.
Wow.
Right? You can do an advanced diploma, an advanced diploma, and a graduate diploma, you know, in energetic medicine and energetic kinesiology.
Right.
You know, and in fact, you can do the advanced diploma and go to Charles Sturt University for another, for one more year, because it's a 3-year, to do advanced diploma is 3 years, and to do one more year, and you get a Bachelor of Science in Health Sciences. Right. So it's a whole here. There's no infrastructure.
No.
And it's aggressively against any kind of infrastructure in this. And so it makes it much harder to run these kinds of integrated trainings, which is, you know, the problem with like kinesiology and a lot of other alternative medicines or alternative techniques, healing techniques, is there isn't any structure. So they're done in workshops here and there and patchy, and coming from, you know, research science, I saw that we needed to have a more structured approach, and you need anatomy and physiology knowledge. You need to know how the acupuncture system really works, how the chakra and nadi system really works. You know, you need to know about nutrition. You know, you need to know about communication skills if you're going to become an effective practitioner. You can't just learn how to kinesiology. You have to have that's a tool.
Yeah.
You need to learn how to use the tool, but have enough knowledge to actually apply it.
Yeah, they right? have, because, having that understanding, and it would be so nice. Saying, I mean, even in Canada, you know, if you have something, you're sort of hit or miss. Like, where to go? Where do you access these tools? Like, you can go to a medical, you know, a hospital, an emergency room, or what have you. But if you're really looking for an alternative doctor that has all of these skills,
can refer to somebody who does have some of these skills.
You know? Exactly.
And there's a number of practitioners in Canada, because my colleague Jackie Mooney, who's been teaching LEAP in Canada, because she comes from Vancouver originally. Yeah. So she's been teaching us, you know, now in a number of the states in Canada. And there's quite a few people who've gone through the program and are working in Canada. And there's actually, I think, more people there than there are here.
Okay.
But now I'm beginning to do more training here. And I'm my purpose is to train more instructors.
Right.
All right. Because that's what you need, and the need for it is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just one of the things that evolved in the last 2 years or 3 years, well, it came out of my accident. And for years, I wondered, I know what I did. I moved chi with my mind to muscles that didn't work, and I activated them. But what was the model? How were they activated? So for 25 years, I just thought about that. And I have to understand things from first principle. That's how my brain thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally realized what I did. And it's also a model that came along, that the way neurons work is they have a very, very unique system. They can only use Krebs cycle respiration to make energy. No, that's not for me. The Nobel Prize was given to Sir Hans Krebs in 1954, right? But it's this description of how you take glucose and turn it into energy.
Right.
Right, and so with Krebs cycle, you have to have oxygen, and you make 36 to 38 molecules of energy, ATP, for every molecule of glucose.
Okay.
You can do it without oxygen in glycolysis and pentose pathways and glutamine pathways, but you make, with glucolysis, you make 4 molecules of ATP. You're never going to run a neuron on 4 molecules of ATP, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you have 38, that's what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So they pushed all that machinery out, so neurons are totally dependent on oxygen. Other cells can survive without oxygen.
Right.
Because they have another way of making an energy, right?
Right, right.
And so therefore, when you have a hypoxic injury like mine, the old model was that they would neurotransmit, boom, dead, right? They just use up the oxygen, then they die.
Yeah.
Well, they're not quite that stupid. It's very much, the good analogy is your laptop. It's not plugged in, you're typing away in your document, and a little battery thing comes up, says 10% battery, and what happens if you ignore it and don't plug it in? Shut down, right? It shuts it down, right? It's not broken, it's not dead, it's just shut down, conserving the fuel, because if you sucked every last electron out of the battery, you'd never be able to reboot it.
That's right.
So it has to hold this residual charge. Well, with the neurons, at about 80% of 20% of oxygen tension, they just shut down the neurotransmission. So they're alive, but they're not neurotransmitting. Now, to all the tests in the West, they're dead.
Right.
Right? So I'm never going to walk again, because you look at my, and you test my test on me, it shows I have enough neurons that are dead. Well, a lot of them weren't dead. They were in this low oxygen mode.
Mm.
They were, and just like low power mode. So what happens, you plug your computer in. Now, most of the time, if you didn't push it too hard, you just wiggle your mouse, boop, it's back up there, you're back in your document, you're typing away. But if you pushed it too hard, you plug it in, you wiggle your mouse, nothing happens. You're typing the keys, nothing happens. You have two choices. Wait 15 minutes for the batteries to charge up a bit, or do what? Turn it off and turn it on again. Reboot from the bottom. Now your document's gone, you got to go find it, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens with these neurons is when oxygen comes back, they should reboot these idling neurons, right? But sometimes they're stuck, and a lot of them get stuck in that low oxygen mode.
Right.
So they're still idling, and they can idle for decades like this, right?
Wow.
And so mine was several years. And so that's how I got walking again, was by rebooting these neurons by moving qi. Well, guess what? I can identify an area of your brain or a pathway in your brain by using acupressure formatting. Then I can use Chinese medicine's law of five elements and move your qi in your brain. And I can reboot your neurons like that.
Wow.
I mean, so it's astounding. I mean, what I've seen kids that couldn't walk or talk, walking and talking.
Wow. You know? This is mind-blowing. This is so
I had this woman that was misdiagnosed with MS for 17 years, right? And so finally, her fifth neurologist looked at all the scans, and so MS is a demyelination disease, and it leaves astrocytic scars, okay? The astrocytes fill in space where the neurons are lost from demyelination, right? So you can see it in the nervous system. She was always atypical. And they never found any real scars. And this guy finally said to her, he said, this is not a white matter problem. That's the tracks, right?
Yeah.
This is a gray matter problem. So when I read his report, that said to me, she had a silent stroke. And a silent stroke is a stroke that doesn't totally immobilize you, but leaves you with lots of really funny little discs. And she looked it up on the internet and it had every one of the symptoms. And so she had a lot of neurons in idling mode. Right? For these 17 years, she'd been doing all this other kind of stuff. I mean, she'd been doing a lot of things like Pilates and trying to keep herself going, but had difficulty walking and balancing and muscle weakness and walking around was hard and all this. But as soon as I saw that, I knew that's a hypoxic problem. So yeah. I just went in and rebooted all the neurons in her somatosensory cortex and the pathways between them. Right, and then did reset the proprioception of the muscles. So that she came to my office this week and sits there and just lifts her leg up and just puts it over other knee, crosses her legs. I mean, like me, I have to lift my leg up. That's how for 17 years, and her husband almost fell off his chair. He hadn't seen her do that in 15 years. Right,
that's amazing.
And these are basically permanent because once you reboot those neurons, they fire, and they wire, which means you get better and better function.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much possibility and potential in this. And I just love that, one, that you went through this. I mean, I'm sorry that you had to do it the hard way, but I'm grateful that you actually took something that was so tragic and turned it into something miraculous. Well, like you say, it's not miraculous. It's just knowing. But to be able to share it with the world
it's still miraculous. I mean, I mean, the person has a muscle that doesn't work or something, and they can't hold it. There's no strength in it. And with all five elements, there may be poking points on the feet or on the hands. And so it's a shoulder muscle. I go down, poke a point in the foot, the muscle's strong. That's still miraculous.
Yeah,
I kind of go,
it is.
Poke the point there, and your brain still kind of goes, huh? Because no matter how many times you do it, it's just as miraculous.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. Well, I'm looking forward to your talk, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in person. I'll be on site at the convention, so it's going to be really exciting. What I know you've got patients and you're busy, so let's wrap this up. But is there something that you really want to make sure that the world, this message that you have to the people?
That there's many more possibilities than are currently accepted for healing, to heal people of conditions that we now see as unhealable. Like me, you'll never walk again. Hello, that's not true. And there are many other conditions, the same thing, like, hey, you're never going to be able to do this again. Now you can. Yeah. So just understand it's a world of possibilities. And we don't know it all yet. We're only learning. But as we learn more, we gain the ability to have greater and greater effect, often with less and less effort. Right, when you move to in frequency medicine, I mean, I'll give it with this woman one more example. She had what's called a positive Babinski's test. So this is from spinal injury, one where they check for spinal injury. If I take my nail and I run it up the center of your foot, your toes should bend down. It's called a Babinski reflex.
Right.
Well, someone who doesn't have that, the toes flex up, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what hers had always done since she had the injury, you know, mm-hmm. since she had the condition. And so the doctor told her, that's it. Nothing can ever be done with that. The nerves are dead. It's finished. In the last session, I did that, and sure enough, they were going up just like typical, negative Babinski test, right? And we call this put that in circuit, so I can then find what's a link to it. I went to a chakra, did acupressure points to balance that chakra. The Babinski's gone. Now, this is a different possibility. And what people are telling you, understand, is that they're not lying. They're telling you, if you do what I do, this is all that can happen, right? But if you do something else, something other possibility may be real.
And that's right? the whole thing is that open-minded, open heart to say, just stop. That's my thing is, let's just stop accepting that only this is it for evolution. I almost get that impression sometimes from the world. It's like, if we haven't done it by now, we're not going to, or we don't know it. And that's absurd.
And if we don't know it, it must not exist.
Yes. And it's time. I mean, there's a lot of people. I'm grateful. There are a lot of people who are looking for this information. So you're going to have your books for sale at the convention?
Yep. Yes, it will. In fact, Denise Cabinati runs the book list, and she'll be carrying them at her stall.
Okay.
She has a lot of books, a lot of other interesting books also.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds terrific. They'll be
there at the bookstore.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to share with us. And for everyone watching, subscribe to this YouTube station and share it with your friends, because you don't know who is going to benefit from having this little bit of information that we have here. If you can't make it to the conference, I mean, it's a start. And then, of course, you can access the books online as well.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, you can't believe my secretary always says to me, how did this person find you? You wouldn't believe how the stories about how they were referred by a friend who heard and the other very, and I talked to somebody. You can't believe the connections that bring the people into my office. And she's just always shaking her head. How did they find you, you know?
Well, that's synchronicity too. Just like all those events happen to you that way, I feel the same way about this broadcast, is that you don't know. Just share it. I mean, what can it hurt? And how can it maybe help someone have a better quality of life? So thanks so much. And thanks to everyone for watching. Until next time, take care.
And thank you, Catherine. Yeah, bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing you.
Isn't that amazing? Thank you to my guests for sharing with us today. Thank you for watching. Feel free to share the link. You can join us for live shows by going to letsgetrealchattingwithcatherine.com and listen to the replays from the show page, preview guests, and explore links to our Facebook fan page, WordPress blog, and more. We are creating an exquisite world. Until next time, take care.